Just a warning before we start, this episode contains some distressing content and the voice of an Indigenous person who has died. I'm Laura Murphy-Oates, and this is The Full Story. On May 25th, George Floyd, a black man living in Minneapolis, was buying some cigarettes from a deli. An employee accused Floyd of using a counterfeit bill, and police were called to the scene.
Relax.
Man, I can't breathe, my face. Just get up.
What do you want?
I can't breathe.
When they arrived, video footage shows that George Floyd was pinned face down on the ground. One officer, Derek Chauvin, held his knee on the back of his neck.
Right, that's bro.
That's bro.
Please, you stopping his breathing right there, bro.
I can't breathe.
Okay, just talk. He's talking. Bro, but you can get him off the ground.
He kept it there for 8 minutes and 46 seconds.
How long y'all gotta hold him down?
This is why we don't do drugs, kids.
It ain't about drugs, bro. Y'all understand
that? Y'all don't gotta put y'all in
his neck, bro.
Right.
He is human, bro.
His nose is weird.
George Floyd died later that day in hospital.
People are torn and hurt because they're tired of seeing black men die. Constantly, over and over again.
I want justice for him because he was good. No matter what anybody thinks, he was good. And this is the proof that he was a good man.
You guys can put your hands on your head, you're all under arrest.
Since then, protests against police violence have erupted across the United States.
Take a look at this. This is a Target on State Street in the Loop, and I can actually hear the music coming out of the store right now because this window is completely smashed in. This is the revolving door here at Target. Again, smashed in. You can see some of the rubber framing here.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been charged by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with murder and with manslaughter. Questions?
This moment is being felt in Australia as well. This week, protests are being held across the country to show solidarity with black communities in America, but also to highlight our own problems with police violence and black deaths in custody. Today, Australia's shameful record on black deaths in custody. It's Thursday, the 4th of June.
So my name's Paul Silver. I'm a proud Dungaddy Aboriginal man located in a small town called Kempsey, located on the mid-north coast. David Dungay Jr. was tragically killed in custody in 2015 in Long Bay Correctional Centre, and David Dungay Jr. is my uncle.
Well, David Dungay is a 26-year-old Dungaddy man from the north coast of New South Wales. He was in Long Bay Jail Hospital.
Lorena Allam is the Indigenous Affairs Editor at Guardian Australia.
He had a chronic diabetes and suffered from schizophrenia. And one day, just a few weeks before he was due to be released, before Christmas in 2015, he had a packet of biscuits in the cell with him and he started to eat them.
When corrective officers asked for him to hand over the biscuits, he refused, so they took it upon themselves to storm his cell with a riot team.
David, my name is Emmett, action team. What I want you to do is come to the door, place your hands through the hole.
Thank you.
As you're going to be cell moved and you get handcuffs on and moved, do that now or force may be used. Do that now. One, two, three, go.
And the immediate action team of guards, five guards, stormed his cell, held him down, restrained him.
They've pinned him to the ground and David Dungay Jr. has continuously and repeatedly said that he could not breathe.
You want to get
I can't breathe, please! Let me out, please, my man!
You
bought the shot,
and shown all signs of positional asphyxia and corrective officers failed to respond to those signs and symptoms.
Stop spitting your blood and you might go away.
Yeah, I'll be quiet.
You're the one that brought this upon yourself, don't you? You'll be face down on the bed, do you understand?
They carried him to a second cell and then held him face down again, and at that point he stopped breathing.
And as a result, David Dunga Jr. tragically died whilst being restrained by five corrective riot squad officers.
Dunga, just comply with all the directions. We'll be out of the cell. Have a night to yourself.
So what we've seen this week in the death of George Floyd is pretty similar circumstances to what happened to David Dungay. Both men were held face down by a group of officers. George was also saying, "I can't breathe," repeatedly. And there's video footage of both these events being shared really widely. The big difference is, though, how large the response has been across the US to George Floyd's death. We're looking at 8 days or more of public unrest. Whereas in Australia, the reaction to David Dungay's death has been nowhere near as much interest in the death of David Dungay.
Have you watched that video?
Up to the point to where George Floyd says, "I can't breathe," and then I have actually stopped the video because, you know, it brought me back to the day when I saw David Dungay Jr., my uncle, being tragically held down and suffocated to death. So I couldn't watch the video all the way through, but, you know, I really do feel for George Floyd's family in the USA and solidarity to everyone in the streets. It is painful to watch a loved one being suffocated. You know, losing someone in any manner is traumatizing, but to watch a loved one being killed and begging for their life is a really another view on it, yeah.
So you have these two similar deaths, widely documented, and yet the reaction in the two countries is so different. Why?
I can't really answer that question without wondering why it is that Australians don't read these stories in the media. It's not as if we haven't covered it. It's not as if other media haven't covered it. And I really don't know why, apart from the obvious, people don't make the connections between what's happening here and what's happening in other countries in terms of deaths in prison and police custody.
Do you think that many people in Australia realise just how bad our track record is when it comes to criminalising First Nations people, black people here in Australia?
I don't believe Australia actually realises, you know, how our track record and our Aboriginal deaths in custody and the injustice against our First Nations people. You know, if they did, I would imagine they would take to the streets in a similar way to the USA. And it's about time us here in Australia really do look at stuff like that, because the injustice against us First Nations people back home in Australia, you know, it's not spoken about as much as it is and as much as it should be in the public eye as well.
So a lot of people have been commenting on this week about this silence in Australia around black deaths in custody and how it's especially odd because by some measures, our track record here is actually worse than in America. Can we talk through some of those statistics for a bit?
Yeah, so the latest figures show, and by latest I mean the 2018 figures of the Australian Bureau of Statistics, show that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander prisoners account for about 30% of the total prisoner population, but the total population of Aboriginal Islander people in Australia aged 18 and over is just around 2%. So you can see that we are wildly overrepresented in the prison population. In the United States in 2017, black Americans represented 12% of the US population of adults, but 33% of the sentenced prison population. So when you account for the size of our populations per head, we are actually way more overrepresented in prisons. Or if you put it another way, we jail Aboriginal people more than Americans jail their black population. And if you look at the statistics around First Nations people in America, you will see that those numbers are even higher than for the black population. And of course, in Australia, we jail people from an incredibly young age, kids as young as 10, 10 is actually the minimum age of criminal responsibility in Australia, and that is way behind most settled and most modern nations in the world. There have been times, including now, when nearly every young person in custody in the Northern Territory is Indigenous. And when it comes to violence against our people, it becomes a bit harder to compare the figures between Australia and America, but if you only have to look at the news right now. I mean, there's a case just this week where a young Aboriginal boy in Sydney was thrown to the ground by the police. He ended up in hospital after landing face first while they were attempting an arrest. And if you know anything about Australian history over the past few decades, or you've ever been to a rally to stop black deaths in custody, you know that we have a massive problem here. I mean, our own figures here at The Guardian have shown there have been more than 430 deaths in custody since the 1991 end of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody. And our analysis has shown that the problem is actually getting worse. There have been at least 5 deaths since August 2019, which was the last time we actually updated our deaths inside database.
Right. It's been a really horrific 12 months for black deaths in custody, but also weirdly historic, because despite these hundreds of deaths, it is incredibly rare in Australia for anyone to be held to account for a black death in custody.
That's right. And out of all these cases, only 3 people have ever been charged under criminal law. One case in Wadair, which is known as Port Keats in the Northern Territory, the officer in that case was charged with murder originally. That charge was downgraded to manslaughter and then eventually dropped. And the other 2, which we can't discuss in much detail because they are before the courts right now, both cases, police officers have been charged with murder. Those officers have both pled not guilty, but if they are convicted, that would make history, because it would be the first time that has ever happened. I need to add a caveat, though, which is that there have been civil cases that have resulted in compensation for families, and 2 really public ones of late have been the case of Miss Du in West Australia. Her family was awarded compensation. And the case of Mr. Ward, an elderly Aboriginal man who died under horrific circumstances. He basically overheated and cooked to death in the back of a police van. And Serco, in that case, were charged with negligence and forced to pay compensation to his family. Overall, no police, no guards, no one has been convicted under criminal law for a black death in custody.
We know that in the case of George Floyd, the police officer involved has now been charged with murder. What happened in the case of David Dungay?
It took 3 years for the coroner to hear David Dungay's case, but the hearing kicked off in 2018. It took 15 days over 2 years, and finally in November last year, the coroner handed down his report. And while the family were hoping for the people involved in his treatment to be held personally responsible, the coroner didn't find that.
You know, with the outcome of the coronial inquest, you know, that was basically for my family and for our supporters and everyone that was there fighting for justice. It was basically a kick in the guts for us.
The coroner found it wasn't appropriate or necessary for the guards to have restrained David, to have transferred him to another cell, and he didn't pose a security risk. They said from a medical point of view, there was no evidence of any acute condition that would have warranted that. But then he said none of the 5 guards involved should face disciplinary action. He said there were systemic inefficiencies in their training and they weren't motivated by malicious intent, but were, quote, a product of misunderstanding between the guards and the Justice Health nursing team on site. Now, that was really distressing for the family and their supporters to hear, because in their view, that wasn't the case.
I would believe that someone should be criminally charged for use of force against David Dungay Jr. What if we take that use of force out? Would David Dungay Jr. still be alive today? I believe yes.
So the coroner recommended changes to the way guards are trained, to teach them the dangers of positional asphyxia, to improve procedures of communication, to insist on better training for the Justice Health nurses that are involved in dealing with Indigenous Aboriginal patients. But as one of our aunties said outside the court after the verdict, how many of our people have to die before they get enough training?
you've been speaking to the family again this week. They're still calling for justice. What would they like to happen?
Well, so the family hasn't given up on holding someone to account for David's death. And there are three things they've called for this week. One is that Safe Work New South Wales prosecute the Justice Health nurses and the Department of Corrective Services because David's death was a death in a workplace. The second thing they intend to do is lodge a complaint with the Healthcare Complaints Commission to investigate the conduct of the medical personnel at Long Bay Jail Prison Hospital. And the third thing is for the New South Wales Director of Public Prosecutions to investigate whether charges could be laid against the prison officers involved.
Yes, they did change a lot of policies and procedures in the coroner inquiry, but they basically blamed it on corrective service organisation. You know, it's one thing to blame an organisation for their failures, but also blame the individuals that was there on the day as well for their partaking. At the end of the day, the organisation didn't have their hands on David Dungay Jr. Individual men did. So why not hold them accountable instead of the whole of Corrective Service New South Wales Corporation?
So really they're looking for some sort of concrete justice, and one of those options is criminal charges. Is there much hope that that will happen?
It's hard to say, but judging by history, it would be unusual.
Next, why people are not held to account for black deaths in custody in Australia. So when you look at these numbers, three charges out of at least 432 deaths and no convictions as yet, it's a pretty unbelievable figure. I mean, why aren't people being held to account for these deaths?
It's a really good question. I mean, reading the coronial reports of deaths in custody, you start to see a bit of a pattern. I mean, coroners repeatedly make calls for systemic change. They frequently recommend officer training. They frequently recommend better procedure. They say things like, this is a terrible tragedy and my sympathies go to the family, but then don't ever refer the case for criminal prosecution. It seems that the system of custody, of corrections, of coronial investigation seems to want to protect itself as the years go on. And often reading those coronial reports, you hear coroners express frustration in their recommendations where they've said, I recommended this happen in a death in custody 2 years ago. Mm. So that there's a frustration among coroners, I think, from reading their reports that very little changes over time. So for someone, for even just one person to go to jail for one of these deaths would be an historic moment. You've got to really reflect on that.
For people advocating in this space, what have they said to you about getting justice for these deaths?
They think that things will only change when custodial and police officers know that they will be personally held responsible for any misconduct in arresting and detaining an Aboriginal person. So it's not until people think there's some personal blowback to themselves that they're going to change their behaviour. They've said to me, people hide behind the system. They say, we didn't get enough training. We didn't know. They didn't tell us that positional asphyxia was wrong. We were under a lot of stress. We didn't know what else to do. And they have said to me, that defence can't hold anymore. People need to be held to account for their actions.
So, Lorena, you've been part of a team at The Guardian that's been tracking Indigenous deaths in custody via a database called Deaths Inside. Can you just explain what that is?
Deaths Inside is a database that tracks every Indigenous death in custody from 2008 up to August 2019. We started it because my colleague Calla Walquist, who was covering the death of Miss Du in Roebourne in WA, she wanted up-to-date figures on exactly how many Aboriginal people had died in custody at the time of that inquest, and she couldn't find those numbers anywhere. And while stats are kept, they aren't kept up to date. So we decided we wanted to track every death in real time. And we decided to also check other data points like a person's gender, their location, whether they're or not they were on remand or whether they were a sentenced prisoner, the nature of their offence, whether or not their treatment required medical intervention. So all sorts of data points. And in order to get a full picture, we read over 470 coronial reports. And for a five-year period of that decade and a bit, we also read every coronial report of every death in custody so that we could get a statistical comparison between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people in the criminal justice system. And we then looked at what those numbers told us about the way that different jurisdictions were handling Indigenous people, and the results were pretty alarming.
Right. This database hasn't just given us a broad picture of the numbers, but it's really highlighted the way in which structural racism works and can lead to the death of Indigenous people in custody. Mm. What are some of the big takeaways that you found from this database?
We found that government failures to follow their own procedures and provide appropriate medical care to Aboriginal people in custody were the major causes of the rising rates of Aboriginal people dying in jail. And the fact is, this is actually getting worse over time. So we published the database in 2018, and then we went back a year later to see how things were tracking. Mm. And we found that there were 17 more people had died in custody in that 12 months since we published, and that other data points got worse. So the proportion of Aboriginal deaths where medical care was needed but not given actually increased from 35.4% to 38.6%. Mm. The proportion of Aboriginal deaths where not all procedures were followed in the lead up to the death increased from 38% to 41%. And the proportion of deaths attributed to a medical episode after restraint, so in the case of David Dungay or George Floyd, had actually gone up from 4.9% of all the deaths in 2018 to 6.5% with new data in 2019.
So we have these coronial inquests, and we actually had a whole royal commission in 1991 in order to learn from the past and prevent deaths in custody from happening. What these figures seem to show, though, is that we're not learning, right?
Yeah. And on top of that, according to the federal government's own measurements, the majority of recommendations dating back to that Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody in 1991 have either not been implemented or only partially implemented.
So are there things that the government could be doing but just aren't, actions that they can be taking?
Well, they could start by implementing the Royal Commission recommendations. There are 339 of them. They've been there a long time. Someone should have read them by now.
Mm.
The key finding of the Royal Commission was the need to reduce the rate at which Aboriginal and Islander people are put in jail. But a recent report said that the recommendations aimed at breaking the cycle of imprisonment and diverting people away from prison had the lowest rates of implementation nationally.
Like to speak. So you wanted to speak to us earlier. Can you just tell me why you wanted to be here today?
Well, first off, y'all wanted to speak with me. That's why you're here. So let's get that straight. I'm here because there's black people dying.
So what do you think about what we've seen today? The police cars getting destroyed, the rubber bullets from police to you guys, all this violence. Is the message lost, or what do you think of it?
No, the message is not lost. This country was built on violence. What are you talking about?
What do you mean the country was built on
violence? This country was built on violence. And I'm not going to give you a history lesson. You should know. And if you don't know, that's the problem.
Well, I really appreciate you giving your perspective, mate, because people in Australia don't have the understanding of the history of police killings and things here. And we really appreciate you talking to us. So thank you.
So we've seen a lot of people talking about what's going on in America right now and highlighting the case of George Floyd. What would you say to people who believe that police brutality and racial violence is something that's a really big problem over there in America, but don't really know about or talk about it happening here in Australia?
I would say just use Google. It's all there in front of you. It's embedded in our history. It's embedded in our history since first contact. Racial violence is so prevalent in our society that most people can't see it. They would much prefer to look at America and go, oh, the Americans, there they go again, that gun-toting Americans, and not look in their own backyard. Mm. Because to do that makes you uncomfortable. And most people want to avoid having to feel uncomfortable about the way this country was settled and the way this country continues to oppress minorities and particularly the First Nations of this country.
I mean, one of the things is that proving discrimination in any particular moment is incredibly hard, right? You can look at all the trends and data, but some people just don't believe that this happens. And what's happened with George Floyd and other cases is that we have video evidence. And these videos show not just what happened in that moment, but what has been happening time and time again in many Black communities.
Right. And it's like you've got video evidence finally of these sort of decades, generations of being gaslit by the system is how I've had it described to me.
Anyway, it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter where you're from.
She swore, so what? If you got your police, you shouldn't be swearing at all.
It's in America.
I didn't say that at all, mate. Yes, you do need to open up your ears.
What? I heard you from over here. I don't need to open up my ears.
No, you did not say that.
I'll crack you across the door, bro.
What was that? What was that? Turn around if I can't see that. Can't go.
We had a case just this week where there's video footage of a young boy being slammed to the ground by police.
Oi! What the fuck?
You just slammed him on the face.
You just slammed him on his face.
He ended up in hospital with various injuries. That video was shared widely over the past few days. And in the context of what's happening in the US and here, it's gathered extra attention from the media because it is an example of what people are talking about.
What the fuck is this? What the fuck is this? He's in pain, Bob.
That's not to say that it doesn't happen every other day on the streets of our cities. Similar things do happen. It's just the timing of events makes this more interesting to people. The officer involved was placed on restricted duties on Tuesday, and we have seen some positive commentary from people that this is not okay.
I think what's happened in the US is a good wake-up call for all of us.
The New South Wales Premier said she appreciated the police have taken action and restricted the duties of the officer involved.
And I think all of our hearts are breaking as to what's happening in the United States, and we certainly have to ensure that we do what we can in our own country to protect all of our citizens.
But
Can I say, look, you look at the video and it is concerning. There is no doubt about that.
The New South Wales Police Commissioner has said
this is a case of two things. One, is it reasonable for someone to swear and threaten a police officer? And then, of course, then is...
You know, they could have handled the situation better, but he highlighted that the Indigenous kid was at fault because he swore.
I would imagine there's people who would say, well, you can't just go around swearing at police and threatening them at them either.
Absolutely. And if someone's threatening police, then there should be consequences for the person who's saying, I'll crack your effing jaw, bro. Let me just ask you about the protest.
What did you think of that response?
I mean, for me, the fact that that child swore at the police officer is a sign that this is a deeply toxic relationship between Aboriginal people and the police. And, you know, the police need to deal with it. It's not okay to just say, well, he swore, therefore he deserved the treatment he got. Police are trained to de-escalate situations. They are trained in how to safely apprehend people, let alone children.
The important message here is that Sydney is not Minnesota, and the situation that we had 2 days ago in Sydney was not unprovoked. The response from the police was not unprovoked, whether or not that provoked.
But is it usual practice to use the kick in that way?
Well, that's what the professional standards review will consider.
And then the police minister this week, David Elliott, stood firmly by the officer. He said the officer had a clean history, that an investigation launched by the force's Professional Standards Command would consider whether he used excessive force based on the threats to him at the time.
I was just as disturbed about the threat from a young person to physically assault a police officer as I was with the response from the police officer.
But the minister also said he didn't believe that the officer should be sacked over the incident.
I mean, judging by these comments and this massive upswell in interest in Black deaths in custody across Australia right now, it seems like Australia is having a bit of a reckoning off the back of what's happening in the US, but it's meeting some resistance and it's coming quite late.
I'd like to think there's a bit of a reckoning happening, But I don't know that that's the case. I mean, we've had marches in the streets before, dating all the way back to poor young John Pat, whose death in custody in WA sparked the Royal Commission. I think that when people stand up en masse and say they are no longer willing to tolerate a certain kind of behaviour, that is when change happens. So if there is an upswell of resistance to the ongoing unacceptable tragedy of Aboriginal deaths in custody, that's great. But sustained public pressure is what will make authorities change their ways.
There's protests happening this week around Australia, I've seen, where people are mentioning the name of David Dungay. How does that feel?
You know, that feels amazing. You know, people actually getting out there and screaming out David Dungay Jr.'s name in the streets is overwhelming. And, you know, my solidarity goes to them. And, you know, this could happen to anyone. An Aboriginal death in custody could occur any time, any place. And me as a family member that has gone through the trauma and still going through the trauma, I really do feel for the families that have gone through the similar thing with an Aboriginal death in custody back home in Australia. You know, and especially to have coronial inquiries hoping to get someone held accountable and basically to be kicked in the head and the guts and thrown out the door with no justice, no criminal charges. You know, it's really a bite on the backside.
I mean, you mentioned that you're still going through the trauma. Can you tell me anything about that for someone who, you know, has never been through something like this?
Well, basically, once you watch a video of a loved one begging for their life, you know, it will traumatise you. And I guess with the trauma that I suffer from what I've seen in the videos, it's just simple stuff. Like, I'll drive past a corrective officer bus and I go into an anxiety attack. I have to pull up on the side of the road. I see an ambulance officer, and because he's wearing a uniform, you know, I get scared. Or, you know, police officers, just anyone with authority about them, you know, it makes me start to shake, literally. And, you know, there's times where I could be driving along in the car and a line of a song will bring up my memory of my uncle, and then instantly the video replays in my mind. It's, you know, the trauma's there and the trauma's bad, and that's just not all there is. But I guess the people that cause the trauma don't really realise what they're putting families through just based on their actions. Yeah.
That's it for today. Thanks to Dorina Allam for her time. If you want to learn more, we've put some links to the latest stories on the full story page. But you should also check out the Deaths Inside database at theguardian.com. It's really worthwhile. This episode was produced by Joe Koning, Miles Herbert and Ellen Lee Beater. Our executive producers are Miles Martignoni and Gabrielle Jackson. Okay, catch you tomorrow.